Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 25. I would rather hustle for 24/7 than slave from 9 to 5. Mongo Wilder.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films. From predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them, the odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Before I get started, I just want to thank everybody in the tribe for all the love that I'm getting back from the new book, Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. I've been reading the reviews. I've been checking out all the messages and social media posts you've been doing about the book. It is everything I wanted and more. I really hope that this book sparks a revolution inside the indie film community. And I really, truly thank you for all the love and support you guys have given me on the book. And if you like the book, please don't forget to leave a review on Amazon or wherever you purchased it. But more importantly, share this book, share the ideas of this book with five of your filmmaking friends. We need to get this information out to as many filmmakers as possible, old, new, I don't care. Get the information out to everybody because it could really change the course of that filmmaker's life. And it is the best Christmas gift you could give them. Now, today's guest comes straight from the pages of Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. Today's guest is Daedalus Howell, and he is the director of a new film called Pillhead. Now, how he distributed and how he created the project from inception is quintessential filmtrepreneurship. He used one of my methods called the regional cinema model. Now, this is when you create a movie or a series or content for a geographical area. It could be your neighborhood, it could be your town, it could be your city, something that really speaks to that community. And you make it for a low enough budget where then you can galvanize the entire community around that movie, and then you can make a business doing films like this. And that's exactly what he did. He created a movie called Pillhead, which is basically an art house exploitation or an art exploitation film. I forgot what he called it, but it's an art house film. And in his area up near San Francisco, it is a very art house kind of community. They love art house films. They love kind of quirky, arty films. And he decided, look, I'm going to make this. And he did it, and I forgot the exact budget. You have to listen in the episode, but I think it was around $30,000 where out of his own pocket, after he got investors and got donations and things, he only had to spend like $7,000 or $8,000 out of his own pocket to make this thing. And he even talked his way into free, mind you, free screenings at all the local theaters where they four-walled his film for free just on a revenue split. That's unheard of with a small, like, indie, micro-budget indie movie. But he was able to do that. And by the way, he was in those theaters for weeks, and he did very, very well theatrically. And that was just one of the multiple revenue streams he created for this project. And he's doing more of these kinds of projects so he could build a portfolio of films like this to keep this process going. So I really wanted to dig deep into how he used the regional cinema model in the distribution and creation of his new film, Pillhead. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Daedalus Howell. I'd like to welcome to the show Daedalus Howell, man. How are you?
I'm grand, man. How about you?
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you reaching out to me and coming on to the podcast and hopefully being, you know, dropping some knowledge bombs from your experience, because I always look for unique, as you know, unique ways of looking at film. And you hit something I hadn't heard before. Hey, how about using your hometown as a backlot? I'm like, that's a podcast. So
I had nowhere else to go, Alex. And now I'm with you.
I appreciate it, man. So first of all, man, what made you want to become a filmmaker? Like, why did you want to become a carny?
Well, that's a great question. I should back up and tell you, I'm from Petaluma, California. And what you may or may not know about Petaluma, we're north of San Francisco a little bit. This is a movie town. And so we were surrounded by all kinds of film phenomena, beginning with like American Graffiti, which was shot here, Lucas. Peggy Sue Got Married was shot here, Coppola. And then through the 90s, Inventing the Abbots, Phenomena, the Lolita remake, Flubber. I mean, it was crazy the amount of like cinematic immersion just in production that was here for a while. And so growing up in that, you get the bug. Compounding that, Lucasfilm was just over the hill in Marin, right? And then you throw in Winona Ryder going to Petaluma High, and this is like super film consciousness in terms of a town. And so a lot of us grew up with, my cohort and I, with this fantasy that we could do it too. And of course, that was summarily crushed, you know, once we all went to Hollywood and you know, as everyone goes through that process. And so I had the bug pretty early, and I had to really figure out how I was going to like deal with having that in my system. I became a writer pretty early on for local newspapers and that kind of thing. So I was able to kind of build a film adjacent career. I could interview film people. Mm-hmm. And when I did finally go to Los Angeles in like the early 2000s, I was principally an aspiring screenwriter, had some minor breaks, that kind of thing. But you know, I washed out and I was left with the disease, you know, the virus was in me. I wanted to make a film, and it got so bad, man. The infection was riddling me.
I always refer to the bug or the thing to become a filmmaker. It's like herpes. Like it literally, once you get it, you've got it for life. It will flare up sometimes, but sometimes it's dormant. But no matter what, it will flare up eventually again. And then sometimes it's really bad and you just start like, oh man, turn into a crack fiend. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, that's a great metaphor, because it's really what happened. And it got to the point where I began to forbid myself to like read about, you know, read film books, to look at anything about indie film, because I didn't want the flare up to come back, because I was feeling so negative about myself from never having done it. Right?
Yeah.
And then I got in a situation where I was between jobs, and my girlfriend said, "Hey, what do you really want to do now? You know, it's kind of wide open." And I said, "Well, what I really want to do is direct." And she didn't know much about production or anything like that, so she didn't know it was impossible. And so she became a film producer, and I became a writer director. And it was just the drive to do it that compelled me. But it was really just you did this with This Is Meg. Mm-hmm. 15 years or whatever, you know, you're like, why haven't I done it? There's no really excuse not to, apart from manifesting the drive to do so. And so that's what we finally did.
No, I mean, I had a horrible experience with a mobster in Hollywood. So that kind of stained me.
I haven't read that book yet, though. I'm going to, though. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I realize it subconsciously stopped me from ever going back. You know, like, why would you go back to the most painful time in your life, and you associate making a movie with the most painful time in your life? So I had an excuse. It was a horrible one, but I had an excuse why I didn't do it. But at a certain point, you know, you and I are both of similar vintages. Right. You know, at a certain point, you just go, dude, I'm not 20 anymore. Like, I can't keep doing this.
Yeah, but the problem is, when you bring that filmmaker identity into your consciousness, and mm-hmm. you're carrying it that long, and you haven't made the the feature film, your life is all plot and no story, man. You start like questioning who you are, and of course, all your friends are like, "Dude, you're a filmmaker, really, dude? I mean, where's your movie?" And you've got a bunch of shorts on YouTube. Who are you? You know, it's all like right. it's so it. Yeah, you just have to do it.
Yeah,
if you're going to do it.
Yeah, and then I hid behind, you know, I did direct like little commercials or music videos and things like that, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And I hid behind post. So I was like, right. It was kind of like nice. It's adjacent. You're still a filmmaker, but you're not doing exactly what you want to do. So it's a great experience, but you hide in that world. So for me, I hid there for God knows about 20 years.
Yeah.
Doing.
Yeah. It. And then you did a podcast, and that, you know, you hid behind the podcast.
And then I hid behind the podcast and behind this. I'll be honest with you. If it wasn't for the podcast and if it wasn't for the tribe, I don't think I would have made This Is Meg. The reason why there was two reasons I did it was because one, I wanted to prove to the tribe that it could be done. I wanted to prove to myself it could be done. I also wanted to use the tribe as something to keep me not compatible, but when you're trying to do something and someone tells you, like, is watching you. I forgot that word, that term. I'm losing my
We'll never find it.
It's over now. I'm sure someone's yelling at it in their car at the moment, but I did it for that reason. And then also, for whatever odd reason, because I was still doing Indie Film Hustle on kind of a side hustle still. It wasn't my full-time gig yet. Mm-hmm. I just said, well, if it doesn't work out, I always have Indie Film Hustle. I could just go back to that. So it's like my safety blanket, you know, and it's become this kind of like, oh, I'm good. I'll just go out. It made me more brave to just go out there, where it might scare other people because you're like putting yourself out there. It's the opposite for me. I find it very comforting knowing that I have not only an audience, but I have a tribe. I have a community that I could always go back to. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Yeah, you know? No, that's really, I think that was one of the smartest moves you've made, you know, and you did, I mean, you've definitely galvanized the community. I mean, you know how they say like the Velvet Underground had 100 fans, but each one of them started a band, you know,
right.
You've got well more than 100 fans, but some film historian is going to trace back this explosion of independent film, and they're going to be able to blame one man. They're going to go, Alex Ferrari, and you know,
that would be amazing. You know what? Honestly, that would be the most wonderful thing ever. Because if I'm here just to help, and I want that, and I get these stories like yours and other people who've listened to the podcast for a long time. Like, I finally made my movie. I finally did this thing, but now it's my job to teach you how to make money with it. But that's why you're here, because you have a unique story behind it. Now tell me about your film Pillhead, great name.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. the general gist is a young art student takes too many pills and wakes up in what's probably a parallel universe, and it's all about finding her way back to her reality, whatever that may be, in a sort of redemptive Alice in Wonderland kind of phenomena. However, we went at this sort of, you know, typical sci-fi style plot, I think, with an art house vengeance. And so I call it an artsploitation film. This thing, it's like your first year in film school. You take a survey course and it's all Jean-Luc Godard and Truffaut and all that kind of thing. Right. I checked every box I could, man. It's black and white. It's moody. It's handheld. It's an aesthetic kind of like hat tip to the French New Wave and all the films I grew up on and that kind of thing. And so it scratched a lot of itches. You know that the flare up was real. and so it's a very different kind of movie, and it doesn't really fit into the general indie landscape, which is a stumbling block in some ways and sort of its differentiator in other ways. And I was able to play that to my advantage. Once I accepted that this is my aesthetic, there's no way around it. I have to make the film I'm going to make, but I have to make it in a way that it's meaningful to my audience. And I knew pretty much who they were because I'm in local media and that kind of thing. And I knew that I wasn't going to make the kind of film that was going to scale and explode. I was making a regional film. I was making a film that was going to be meaningful to where I'm from and the people in my community. And that sounds a little backwards because you want your film to be as big as possible often. You want it to go everywhere. But I'm really hooked on this notion of regional cinema, the way that there used to be like regional theater, right? There'd be like a playhouse, and then they'd put on a regular program, that kind of thing. I wanted to start something wherein I could credibly create films and know that I had an audience here and do it on a regular basis. And the trick to that, of course, is making them inexpensively, making them profitable, and making them for an audience that you know is going to come back. And so I knew I was going to make a Petaluma film.
That's what regional cinema, the regional cinema model is for you. Because that's the first time I've heard that term. And is it, it might be out there in the zeitgeist, but I've never heard of it. Yeah, I've never heard of it. And generally speaking, if I don't hear it, I've never heard of it, it's a weird thing because I'm pretty much inside of this world all the time. So when I heard that, I was like, interesting. So now that's the definition of it. And where we're taught as filmmakers, especially our generation, but even younger filmmakers, that everything's got to be huge. It's got to be big. It's got to be blockbuster. You've got to make $100 million. And, you know, what Filmtrepreneur is about is to start bringing it down to niche audiences, to bringing it down. Now you've created the regional aspect of things, which is awesome because now you're doing basically what I've been preaching, but doing it on a regional standpoint as opposed to a niche. It is a niche, but it's a regional niche. Regional niche. And if you as a filmmaker have a region that you know that you can sell movies to and you can make those movies for a budget and you can recoup your money and continue to make, that's a business. That's a business. And if it goes somewhere else and it goes international or it sells outside online somewhere to a bigger audience, fantastic. But your core audience is what is going to sustain your career. That's a really powerful thing. And it also gets that lottery ticket mentality out of the filmmaker's head, which is like, I need to make something. This movie's got to pop for me. I need to go to Hollywood. I need to do. You don't. You could keep it small. And as long as you're cool with not living in the Hollywood Hills and you could just have a lifestyle, buy a house, pay your rent, and enjoy it, like make enough money to sustain you and your family comfortably and make your art. Well, hell, that's the dream.
No, that's you're totally right. And that's the metrics of success. Can you do it again? Is it supporting you versus, like you're saying, the lottery ticket where it's supposed to make your career overnight? That's just not going to happen anymore, unless you're in that system, which, I would gamble most everyone listening is not clustered in Hollywood. Maybe they are, but even if you're here,
it's a lottery ticket. There's one guy like you and I were raised in the 90s. Like we came up in the film industry, like in the 90s, where independent film, like every freaking week, there was Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, Kevin Smith, Richard Linklater, Spike Lee, John Singleton. I mean, it just kept, Steven Soderbergh. Every week there was a new magic lottery ticket being handed out.
And Sundance was just stamping these guys out.
It
led us to believe that that's the system. That's what you do. You show up, it happens, and it doesn't. And that could really derail your life artistically.
Tell me about it.
So I had to really pull back and figure that out. And once you scale stuff to not just a level where you can actually make it, but you know who's going to watch it and you know that you're going to earn it back and beyond, it changes your mindset. And there's a lot more freedom in it, especially if you know your niche, you know what you're doing now. And I totally agree with you. Regional cinema is a niche, and the niche is the region in this case. And I grew, where I live is it's a very special place. And so I knew it was fairly dependable. But there are ways to galvanize that and make it happen. So we set about with our production, and I have to tell you, I was talking earlier about the artsploitation factor. I knew this is going to be intrinsically not a mass market film. There's just no way about it. Sure. But I knew, and if I did anything other than that, I wasn't going to be, my artistic integrity and all that BS wasn't going to be intact. But if you're going to make a film at our age, after not having made a film, you're going to make your goddamn film the way you want to make
it. Right? Absolutely.
So I had to dovetail that into a concept that would work. So I was on a radio program yesterday, and a guy pointed out, he goes, hey, Petaluma is kind of a character. And I'm like, that's right. The town, I made the town look, I wouldn't say beautiful, but I gave it a vision that this town hasn't seen itself that way before. And I think that had resonance, and that's something that's talked about a lot. But to kind of like roll back and like how to do this kind of thing, you're going to need a lot of favors. You're going to need a lot of buy-in from like the sort of civic, like bureaucracies that you have to participate in. And you're going to have to become friends with the local press, and you're going to have to have a story that's beyond local filmmaker does good, we've seen that story, right?
It's not 1982. Yeah.
No one cares. Everyone's making a movie right now. They'd rather write about the YouTube kid than they would you. So, I just hunkered down and wanted to tell the story that I told. And, uh, but I wanted to make the film. I didn't want to do too much guerrilla stuff. I knew that I had to do it legally. By that, I mean like permits and insurance and all the things. And I needed to keep it cheap, lean, and fairly invisible because I couldn't afford to close off streets. I couldn't afford to I couldn't ask any businesses to stop their business for me, that kind of thing. And so the first thing was, you know, to ensure the production, you have to be permitted. And to get that permit, I had to appeal to the city of Petaluma. And I go to them and, you know, so in Petaluma, as I mentioned before, has seen a lot of film, right? Mm-hmm. And they're used to big budgets coming in, and they make cities make money on movies through transitory occupancy tax. That means heads and beds, right? Crew comes in, 50 plus people or more. They those people are put up at hotels. They're eating at local restaurants, local services. So films can be a big money maker for a city. So when you come in and say, "I got this little itty bitty film, please give me a film permit," they're like, "Well, okay, sure. We're not going to deny you your freedom of speech, but what's in it for us?" Especially since in my case, I wanted a discount. And no one thinks that you can negotiate with a bureaucracy, but you totally can, especially the smaller town, because the mayor is your neighbor, right? Mm-hmm. So I wrote a letter to the city manager. They wanted, I think, $200 a day or $225 a day or something like that. You know, that was their deal. $225, and I had like a 20-day shoot, right? That's not a significant amount of money to the city. It's like, what, $4,000 or something like that? But to me, that was like a budget breaker, right? Mm-hmm. So I wrote a letter to the city manager, an email, and I said, "Hey, here's the deal. I'm a townie. I'm a local. Everyone here is local. It's locally cast. It's all this. Here's the general pitch." And the guy wrote back and said, "How about $300 flat rate?" In.
Done.
I'm like, isn't that great? You can do that, right? And so then I went through Fractured Atlas, which is a nonprofit sort of fiscal sponsor. You know, they're if you can't receive donations yourself because you're not a nonprofit, they'll vouch for you and receive those funds. And they have an amazing insurance policy situation where they broke out some deals so they get discounted insurance for production. So I was able to take that, get discounted insurance, which is what the city wants. They don't want you to mess up anything, and they want to insure you. So then I had to go. Most cities will ask you to go to the local merchants. It's usually like a chamber of commerce or a downtown merchant society or something like that, because their main concern, and this was a concern in Petaluma, and it kind of led to a lot of productions being shut down or not even shut down, like blocked from coming in. Merchants complain about streets being shut down, sidewalk traffic ending, foot mm-hmm. traffic gone, no customers, right? Even if they're compensated by a studio or whatever, it's never enough. Everyone's grumpy, and it's so disruptive to local business. So when you have a lean little production like ours, you're not going to impact them that way, but you got to tell them that. And that was the weird part. I didn't expect to go to a local business and say, "Hey, man, we're going to be shooting here. Here's my flyer." You have to, you know, announce it that way. That's where I got the first bit of like pushback. I was like, "Dude, we're just a small, I mean, we're going to look like tourists. There's only five of us, you know, in a camera." Mm-hmm. And they were so suspicious and so kind of like, mm-hmm. "No, we remember what happened last time, you know, like, you know, I can't remember the film, but it came, I think Scream was shot in locally, and it ruined the town for a few weeks." Right. So they were pretty chapped about that. And I just had to sit down and talk with them. And eventually I surfaced up to the chairperson of the downtown association. And I just pled my case and made it clear to them that we're not going to shut anything down. This person happened to be a Mason, right? Mm-hmm. And through that person's influence, everyone just jumped in. And then the Masons said, "Do you need a building to shoot in?" I'm like, "Yeah." And they gave us their building. We shot in a Mason temple at one point. It was crazy, man.
So awesome.
It's that local boy makes good angle, but more like, we're doing this together. We're doing this for these reasons. This is how it aligns with what you're trying to do. And we're not going to cost you a thing. And we're not going to tell you we're going to make your business look good and it's going to be an advertisement for you or anything like that. But we are going to respect you and your business, and we're going to make this as seamless as possible, and we're going to make it fun for you. You want a cameo? Great. You know, that kind of thing. And so that's
the power of the cameo. Oh, yes. Just,
which is the most, yeah, as everyone knows, the most BS thing ever, because that usually is the first thing gets cut, right?
that and the associate producer credit.
But, oh, my God. Got a couple of those. Yeah.
So that's what a merchant buy-in is? What is that exactly?
That's how I would characterize it, is because you're going to need the streets of your small town, as if you're shooting exteriors and you're using their storefronts and their backgrounds and that kind of thing, you're going to get location releases from them, you know, and that kind of stuff. And you want them to love what you're doing versus being afraid that you're going to cost them money by blocking their customers from getting in, or intimidating people, or people don't want to be on camera. People are afraid of being caught up in something. People don't want to be in a movie called Pillhead. I get it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you start just literally on the street level, going door to door saying, this is what we're doing. We're insured. We're playing by all the rules. We're not going to make a mess, and we're gonna try to make this a pleasurable process for everyone. And most of the time they get into it. We gained more locations than we were a threat of losing, because people said, hey, why don't you shoot my building too? You know, when we had a place that just schedule wise wasn't going to work out, another guy stepped up because he was like, yeah, this sounds like a lot of fun. You guys are, you know, doing a great thing here and that kind of thing. And so that's a place to start on the street level, right?
Now, what was the budget on this film?
Just a smidge under $30,000.
Okay, so it's a low budget. People will argue micro budget.
Totally. I don't even think it qualified for the micro budget SAG agreement. The ultra low. I mean, no. We paid. That's the thing. To keep within the budget, we flat rated all the performers, and so sure, everyone got $100 a day. Yeah. Across the board. And that's great, because that keeps the spirit of the thing alive. These people are getting paid. Mm-hmm. They're paid actors. That's mm-hmm. huge for them, because we're often in small towns just starting their careers and that kind of thing.
That's huge. Normally they wouldn't even get paid to be in a feature in a small town. So that's a big plus.
You have to do it, you know. And mm-hmm. we used a casting director. Remarkably, we have one up here, I guess because there's a lot of extras needed when the big films come in. Mm-hmm. So this was the chance for the casting director to break some talent, and it was great for everyone. But we paid everyone, which makes them accountable, right? They show up, they take it seriously. But at $100 a day, I think the minimum for a SAG agreement is $125. I just couldn't make it pencil, man. So they didn't get their, you know, SAG units, but they don't care. Right?
Yeah, yeah. It's not about the SAG units. How many days did you shoot, by the way?
20. And so here's the thing, man. In the middle of our production, the big California fires in Northern California mm-hmm. happened. And Petaluma wasn't affected necessarily, but all the surrounding area was. And so we were smoked out, and we had to shut down and reschedule, which was pretty traumatic for a small scale production. And there's a moment, of course, where I'm like, we're never going to get this done. This isn't going to happen. But Karen Hass, our producer, was able to like triangulate, work it out, get all of the merchants to come back on board on different days. You know, the first thing that happens though, when there's a catastrophe like that, is that all of the monies, all of the donation kind of stuff, like the free catering and that kind of thing, that goes right out the window, because they're diverting that energy and resources to, you know, people who actually need it, mm-hmm. you know, fire victims and that kind of thing. Completely makes sense. But that was something we never accounted for, of course, and we had to figure out how we're going to patch all these holes, you know. Fortunately, there's a local woman who makes tamales, and so we lived on tamales for a week or so. But
No, can I tell – I want to tell you a quick story. Yeah, yeah. My first film, Broken, was my first short film in 2005. We shot in a – it's arguably an abandoned hospital, but there's four floors that are abandoned, but the rest of the hospital is functional. So the basement was like, and it's like from the 40s and the 50s, there was like ancient stuff. And like, there was entire like floors full of props, basically. They'd just been sitting there for decades. And they're like, go have it, go at it. And they originally were going to be for $500. And at the end of it, they had such a good time with it. So like, yeah, don't worry about it. So we got the whole place for free. But the problem is, the week before we were shoot, a hurricane hit us, because we were in West Palm Beach. So a hurricane hit our area. And when we drove up there, like, everything was destroyed. A lot of flooding happened, all of this stuff. So we just incorporated it all into the story. We just said, screw it. We got to roll. We're shooting in 5 days. This is happening. But the best part was that FEMA, because it was a hospital, set up shop there.
Oh my God.
And there was hundreds of thousands of people in line outside while we're trying to shoot a movie. So you got to roll with the punches sometimes.
You got to roll with it, man. Like, now you have a great production design and a cast of thousands, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's the thing though. When you're a lean, small production, you can pivot like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And so if you do have a natural disaster, you can actually either incorporate it or at least in our case, reschedule and make it work. But so that was a setback, but generally speaking, everyone was appreciative and understanding of it and that kind of thing. And so throughout our post-production, we kept everyone abreast of what was happening, that kind of thing. Because once you go into post-production, like it's like your film disappears. No one cares.
You're in the cave for months.
Totally. And no one knows what's happening or if it's ever going to or if it's ever going to happen. So we would dribble content out.
Well, I was going to ask you, did you you obviously understand who your target is, which you're very, it's a niche audience, but it's a very broad, you know, you've got a lot of spectrum of people there. So how did you realize that your movie, which is an art exploitation film, would resonate with this audience? Did you do any market testing? Did you like, what was the other than just being shot in that town? Do you think that was enough to gather everybody to come to see your movie?
That was a start. That was definitely a platform that we could start with. But that's a great question. I knew that given the sort of demographic makeup here, it's a pretty arty town. We're very close to San Francisco and there's a lot of people who go back and forth between here and the city. So it's sort of, it's a suburb. So it's got a kind of a cosmopolitan edge to it in some ways. And the local movie theaters are multiplexes, and have the usual stuff. And so there's no art house films as such. So I always knew that I was going to pursue some kind of local theatrical distribution to kind of like, to slake that thirst for that kind of content in this area. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we're blessed that we got a couple of like old school venues that used to be old movie theaters that can still do it that are now music venues and that kind of thing. And so I always had an eye to like reviving this art house phenomena in town. And
so it's a consortium, if you will, a consortium of local local exhibitors.
So yeah, that's my joke because it's, you know, every small town has – most small towns have movie theaters. Most of those movie theaters are going to be owned by somebody, right? And that's often a local business person. Or if it's a chain, you can figure out where the basis of that chain is, and oftentimes they're regionalized. In because of the nature of how these businesses are put together, they're often they could be like a big AMC theater, but they're actually local franchisees, that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. so – or something, I'm not sure for that particular chain, but that's how it often works. And so you can find through some internet sleuthing, like who actually owns the theater, right? And it's usually a small company, that kind of thing. Up here we had a fairly small market, relatively speaking, two separate exhibition companies, right? That between the two of them represented most of the theaters in town. And so I knew that those guys had to be my friends, right? And I needed to make a case that our film would be worth the risk of slotting, against the Avengers in this case, you know. And so what we did was I knew that a good, healthy cast and crew screening would at this point I had faith in the film. It was cut. We had a great mix. I knew that we had something that was really going to make the town lose their shit, right? Mm-hmm. And so I booked a theater in town called the Mystic, which is one of these old single screen, funky, mm-hmm. fairly large venue, beautiful place that has turned into a music venue, but they still had the screen. And I approached them and I said, well, you know, what's your rate for a single night screening? We're near a cast and crew. And it was like $3,000. And again, you know, deal breaker for me. And so I made the case. This is a local film. It's local talent. It's local this, local that. I just really sold them on, this is your opportunity to be a hero to the cast and crew of this film and their friends and family and bring new eyes to this theater who haven't seen it in this capacity in 30 years, right?
Nice hustle.
And they're like, yeah, total indie film hustle. And they saw the merit in that and they shaved it down to like $1,000. Then, which is great, still, that's $1,000, right? So then, in fact, I have one here. I got myself a designer, my producer, and we made a program. And then we sold advertising in that program, right? Mm-hmm. To underwrite the presentation of the cast and crew screening at this theater. So we sold $1,000 worth of advertising. Then, of course, these had to be printed. I go to the print shop. I'm like, hey, man, I could go to, you know, FedEx, Kinko's or whatever, or we could keep it local, you know, Petaluma Printing, and we'll throw an ad in there, and the guy just shaved it down to like practically zero. We had to staple them ourselves, but we totally hustled it, and we passed these out, and everyone was happy. And so, if I could put them in the special thanks, I did, you know, the credit roll, but the film was pretty locked at that point. But all, you know, all these advertisers were like, you know, and of course they got to come to the screening, because that's the thing, man. I wasn't selling any tickets, right? I told the cast and crew, come on down, bring as many friends as you want. The theater's capacity was 300 or something like that. And I set it up on Eventbrite so I could register that capacity. And I wanted on Eventbrite, you know, they show you how many tickets are remaining. Even though they're free, you want to see that number like dwindle and get down, down, mm-hmm. down. And then there's surges, right? And so we packed that place beyond capacity, right? We had a line out the door, which everyone wants to see. I invited all of the local press to see that line and the local exhibitors. So they come and they see this film. And of course, you know, it's cast and crew. Everyone's cheering. Every time some new face pops on, it's a round of applause, right? And it was a really spirited, fun, up, great event. You know, the film's 80 minutes, so you're in and out, mm-hmm. right? But we kept the party atmosphere going. It was really great. And that's what happens is the press, the exhibitors, they come up to you like, that was really great. That was really exciting. You know, what's your next step? Next step is a bunch of lunches the next week. We do a bunch of interviews and we do some deals, right? And what we negotiated with the exhibitors, they have, you know, theatrical exhibition is kind of weird where they need to, they kind of loss lead on the film, right? In some way on films, right? So it's they're moving popcorn and concessions, that kind of thing for the first few weeks, right? Mm-hmm. Big film comes in, they take a dive on the ticket price, but and then the longer the film stays there, the more their percentage of the box office goes up, as you know. Correct. And so I knew that. I couldn't really tolerate that threshold, you know, because I needed to make some money now at this point. And so because of the nature of our sort of the awareness we'd created in town and all that, and because I knew some press was coming up and all that, I was able to tell the story of getting into, you know, how we're having a local exhibition. It makes the film seem successful because no one gets distribution, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, unless you go out of a 40-mile square radius, you don't know the film's not everywhere, right?
Right.
It's in the movie theater, right? And so we did a straight-up 50-50 split, right? Which is astounding.
It's huge for them. It's huge for them.
Yeah. And so they got more money up front on a Thursday night from our little film than they did with Endgame, which is playing the theater next door because there's five guys in there, right? Because that film had been played out a little bit. And so it was a win for them and it was a win for us. And they have all their stuff wired. So like, you know, they're taking the tickets and all that. And we had to invoice them at the end of the month. They send the money and the money shows up and it's great. And so we ran for a couple of weeks in four different cities. That's the thing. That's what you don't want, just one theater. You want to leverage your press as wide as you can and in as many markets as you can, even though it's ostensibly the same community and the same type of audience, they live in different places sometimes. And we have enough regional media that I was able to like push that. And once you get one story, you can push that story to other places. I got lucky because one of the newspaper chains here has a reporter. You know, they're cheap on their reporters, so they get one guy to write it, but they run it in three different papers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fine by me. So here's an example. You know, here's one clip. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is, of course, the hard copy. It has more of a life online. Mm-hmm. You know, it's another clip.
Right. Same article.
Same exact article. This one was different. This is a shot from the movie. This is the cover, man, of a local alternative news weekly. They just jumped on it, man. We made it a story because we had 300 people who had a great time talking about how great it was and then looking for the paper. So then that's how you do it, man. You start small and you keep it focused and you knock on the doors that you know will open for you in your town and you keep the spirit alive with it. And so this all snowballed to our Amazon release. But anyway, that's kind of like the
– So how much did you make on this theatrical release? What was the kind of revenue, generally speaking?
We were making about $1,000 a week, right?
Okay.
And so it made a dent in our initial outlay. And that's the other thing. The film was in part underwritten by Indiegogo, right? Mm-hmm. Not significantly, but a few $1,000. We got a private donor, right, who came in for a couple grand to begin with. And then midway through, I'm like, I need more money. And I just asked him again, and he was cool enough and kicked down another few grand. And our post, we did ourselves. We built our own, you know, system, out of bits and pieces, and used Premiere in this case. We got a real break though in the mix. Central Post LA down there up Barham did our mix through. I did some music videos for these guys back when they were running some label stuff. And my brother is kind of a mid-level rock star. I worked with those guys, and so they did the mix for free. I mean, that was huge.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I shouldn't say for free. They
deferred points.
Yeah, indeed. And they're great associate producers. I'm very happy to have worked with them. And if you ever need good post, man, that's where it's at. So
good associate producer credit.
But so we made a dent in that, and then that's for one theater. So we had four theaters. Some theaters did better than others, and ran multiple nights in most of them. And so we are now. Oh, that's the other thing. Let me backtrack a little bit. We didn't have enough money to make the film when we started, but we knew that we could keep making money while we're making the film to keep paying everyone and paying it off.
Ooh, I think that's a dangerous business plan, sir.
Well, is it though? Because you could either not make your film, could either wait till you have your whole budget and not make the film, or you can know that you're going to, you have your day job and you're going to sink a little bit of your paycheck into the thing.
As long as if you have a revenue stream that you know it's coming to cover your nut, then yes. Yeah, but I've seen too many filmmakers start like, we have 10 grand, but we really need 50. We're just going to start. We don't know where the other 40 are coming from. That's dangerous.
No, that is dangerous. I don't advise that, but I do advise making a film if you know that that if you don't have the budget all at once, that you're at least going to accumulate the budget, actually accumulate it, not pretend you are, but actually know you're going to earn that money or acquire that money through production and post, mostly in our case, so that you actually are still making that film. There's nothing worse than having a film on your hard drive and waiting for somebody to write a check that's not going to happen, and you never do it. It's better just to keep moving as best you can. And the other, keep it as cheap as possible. So this is 30 grand, but this is 30 grand over 18 months. That's still a lot of money, but that's a lot of money in smaller chunks.
So what was the total that you actually had to recoup after everything was done?
Oh, of our own actual outlay, yeah. Right?
And investors or donations? Was it all donations or investors?
It was all donations or Indiegogo kind of stuff.
So like actual money you had, like what was the to make this go into the black?
To recoup our personal out of pocket expenses, we only needed about 8 grand. You know,
if you can't make 8 grand with an independent film, then you really shouldn't be making an independent film.
Right. And you can do that. And the great thing is, we own it too, and it's part of this growing library. And now it lives online, and, Amazon sends us the little statements every, and so they don't need to send it. I check every day, but there's, it's better to have done and do and start building your intellectual property empire and have something to leverage. And here's the thing with Pillhead, it's not a standalone property. The way I constructed it, it speaks to and actually features other things that I've done. So there's this character who has a book called Quantum Deadline that's a kind of a MacGuffin in the movie, which is also a book that I wrote that's published. And so I'm selling the book in conjunction with the movie.
Product placement.
But it's not just product placement. It's a plot device. It's transmedia. You see, they share the same story world. So the movie and the book kind of exist in the Lumiverse, for lack of a better term. And so that's how I'm kind of thinking of this long term. It's like keep building the world and properties that exist within that world and own all of it. And so it could be a longer game, but it's a better game to play, I think.
So then how was your online marketing game? Like how did you, because you have this audience that you're trying to reach. How did you reach this audience? How did you, reach out to this audience, your regional audience, and then also beyond?
So what I did first for the regional audience, because we did that cast and crew screening through Eventbrite, which, it's just it's a free ticketing service at the level we were doing it, that allowed me to capture all of their emails. So not only did I have my cast and crew emails, I had all their friends and family at that point. Mm-hmm. And so that was a list of, you know, 300 plus people, which doesn't sound huge, but it is huge when you want your numbers to spike on your first day of release. And you say, hey, everyone, remember that great time we all had last month or a couple months ago? If you missed it in the theaters, here's the chance to really deep dive into this film. And I hope that the film can endure repeat viewings. And so, because it's got a lot of Easter eggs and stuff like that in it. And so that's how we did it. We just did a blast, encouraged everyone to share it. Of course, we leveraged social and all that. And you can triangulate through emails, like, you know, where people are on different social platforms, and you can mm-hmm. invite them to fan, you know, like your fan page and that kind of thing. And so that's how I started. And then I started with press releases and just sending them out to places that I thought would cover the film. And I'm still in that process in trying to push the online. But that's a little – so that's a little outside of the regional model. That's a whole different kind of it's more traditional in that at this point.
It's another revenue stream. It's a hybrid. It is. It's a hybrid model.
Yeah, and you have to keep doing that and keep that alive because it keeps it in the consciousness. And so I send out a press release or some sort of appeal to a reviewer or a blogger. And it doesn't have to be like, you know, a huge place. Any mention helps, you know. And so that's what I do. And it only takes, you know, it's templatized at this point. So it takes a couple of minutes every day or every week in my case. And that's what I'm doing.
Now, and have you built an online community on Facebook at all or on different social media platforms?
Yeah. Because I was a local author and all that, I was able to use my own kind of presence, right? And so I'm generally the face of the film, even though there's a wonderful cast and crew. I got to push it, right? And so through my own Facebook, you know, I've got like only 1,500 followers, but they're really great. And they're really responsive. And so they're not like your tribe where they, you know, if you ask them to, you know, march and take bullets for you.
I don't know. You're giving way too much credit, sir. Giving me way too much credit.
My tribe goes, oh, this guy, this asshole again. All right. but it keeps it moving. And I know it's working because I see the hockey stick, you know, in my Amazon results, but I also get really great feedback. For whatever reason, Pillhead is the kind of film that people, if they get into it, want to talk about it and tell me about it, which is really great. And so I've met people online who just say, hey, I watched your film, man. I really dig it. Did you mean this by that? That kind of thing. They're trying to decode some things. The dude I was speaking with yesterday on the radio kind of nerded out on me. He was putting out things that weren't, in my opinion, in the film, but I was like, yeah, dude.
Sure.
That you believe that, let's go for that. And I don't mean that like in a you know, cynical way. I just mean like, you know what it's like. People find something that you didn't maybe intend, but that's mm-hmm. important to them, and it's important to let them have that.
Oh, you know? There's no question. I mean, I know Kubrick understood that very well.
Yeah, he was brilliant, not even talking about anything, you know.
Exactly. Just like, you guys figure out what I meant. I don't, you know, it's much more interesting. Now, did you, at any point, did you consider doing traditional distribution? Did you go down that road at all? Or was this planned from the beginning and like, we're doing this all the way?
Okay. It was planned from the beginning that we were going to make a completely comprehensively unmarketable film, right? And it sounds weird. And it sounds like a rationale after the fact, but truly, Alex, my producer and I were like, we had done some conceptual art installations. We were all about the creative, and which can be a healthy thing, but also it's not going to make you any money.
Right.
The idea was to make the film we wanted to make about this place for this place. And that was the audience. So as long as we stood, you know, just kept to the principle, like this is Petaluma film for Petalumans, that was going to be enough to take it over the hump. But there is that little part of you, of course, that goes, it would be cool though if this got picked up, and it would be a hell of a lot easier if it did. And so early on, I looked at the distributors that were distributing the kind of films the art house films of a peculiar kind of psychedelic nature, like this one. And it, you know, it comes down to like, there's the big ones like Annapurna and A24, that kind of thing. And there's like a little ones like Oscilloscope. None of those guys wanted to talk to me. And I knew that, and I kind of needed to lob that out there to confirm for myself that I got to stay on my path.
Right.
And even if they wanted to pick it up, I don't think there's the investment for this kind of film. And this film was so regional in its scope that it wouldn't make sense really outside in some ways. However, I found it's a little more universal thematically than I'm probably giving it credit for. But no, I you know, there's the darkness is always lurking, right? And it's and the seduction of you know breaking through somehow is always there. But you got to stick to your own thing. It's the only, you know.
And then how about film festivals? You didn't decide to go down the film festival route either?
I considered it. And I remember looking at the Film Freeway, you know, lineup and thinking, this one looks good, that one looks good. I did the, you know, I took pleasure in submitting to Sundance and giving them my $100 to support
independent. It's a fantastic donation. It's a fantastic.
Yeah, and that's and I knew that going in. I had never submitted a film to Sundance. I had no delusion that it was going to get in, but I wanted to have participated in that finally. Does that make sense?
it's such a strange Sundance is such a unique film festival in the scope of the world. I mean, unlike any other film festival anywhere in the world, especially for people in the U.S., Sundance is it, and we know that it's astronomical to get accepted.
Right.
We know we have almost a better chance of winning a lottery or a scratch off than we do of getting our film in. Was last year was like 15,800 submissions,
yeah,
and 120 films got in, including shorts. Yeah. So if you go on the features, it's even less. Like the chances of you getting in are so astronomical. But then we all turn into Jim Carrey and Dumb and Dumber. You're saying, but there's still a chance.
Right.
But you're saying there's a chance. And yeah, that little dream is what kind of, you know, look, I fell into, like, when I made Ego and Desire, which was a film about Sundance.
At Sundance, yeah, yeah.
At Sundance, without Sundance permission, I waited a year to submit to them because I was like, if I'm ever going to get a chance, this is it. And I wasted a year. You know, I wasted a year of my time, you know, chasing that film festival dream. So I always find it fascinating when filmmakers now are just saying, you know what, I don't think the film festival route is for me. And it's not for everything. And it's not what it was in the 90s. Like, you know, like Sundance was stamping them out. They don't do that anymore. There is no festival that does that anymore.
Right. And the festival culture has changed quite a bit too. And what's considered a festival worthy film is way different. Right. And not just in terms of like, you know, production value and that kind of thing, but you know, a lot of them want stars. A lot of them want,
they want asses and seats. They want asses and seats. They want press.
Yeah.
And that's, look, it's star. You need star power. There's two ways you get into a film festival: star powers, or that you can prove that you can fill that those seats and those showings by your audience. Whatever that, you know, if you're a YouTuber who made a film and you say, "Hey, look, I got 5 million subscribers, and I'm gonna get how many seats do you need? 300 filled? Yeah, that's not a problem.
Yeah,
that's the way you get in.
I didn't have that, and so I knew that I'd have to like make my own breaks. The other thing was I put myself on this timeline, right? I booked the first screening before the film was done, right? Mm-hmm. Because I needed the deadline and I needed to like really push it. And I know that sounds a little risky, but we have the technology, you know, it just takes the drive to finish. And that's mm-hmm. what we did. I mean, like up all night, you know, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. but it was worth it. And it's exciting, you know, but no, this is not a festival film, man. And that was kind of a weird thing to accept, you know, cause I had, you know, I'd been as everyone, we've been through these festivals, we've seen what the culture's like, it's fun, but it just has changed. And there's such a deluge of content now. And our little black and white weird art flick is just not the kind of thing that's going to play.
It's not. And trust me, look, you know, with Ego and Desire, I was rejected from all the major festivals. I mean, I got into Rain Dance. I got a world premiere at Rain Dance, which was huge.
That's pretty great. Yeah.
I was so blessed about that, but I was rejected by every other one. And I realized, I was like, you know, I think other festivals just have a big stick up their butt about promoting Sundance at their festival. Like, you don't want to be thinking about another festival while you're at my festival.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And I was like, you know, because anyone who watches a film really enjoys this. It's a filmmaking movie. It's about filmmakers selling a movie at a festival. Like, why wouldn't that play? It's a perfect film festival movie. But
yeah,
yet it didn't. So it's odd, man. I've been in over 600 festivals throughout my career with all of my projects. It's changed so much.
Tastes have changed. Yeah, tastes are different too. I mean, like the people who go to film festivals, it's usually an older demographic now, and there's a lot of baby boomers. They're kind of looking for the thing that speaks to them. You know, no one wants your punk rock weird movie. You know, it's better to project it on
unless Brad Pitt's in it. Unless Brad Pitt's in it.
And if Brad Pitt's in your punk rock movie, it's not a punk rock movie anymore, man. You know what I mean? So.
Exactly. So you've got
no diss on Brad Pitt. He's great, but
yeah, but there's that whole thing as yeah. well. It's remarkable, man. But look, and also I wanted to say, I saw on your website you have some merch. Have you been selling that merch? Has it made any money? Have you created any revenue off of it?
Yeah. And so that's the thing. I put it all on the front page of dhowell.com, and that's a constant stream. It's really great, man. It's not like huge, but it's definitely buying groceries.
That's you know, awesome.
I'm selling the film. I'm selling the books that are related to the film. And on the site, you see that I kind of explain what I'm doing. Like, this is all one world, and these are the different pieces. And you can dive into the book, or you can watch the movie, and there's more to come. And stay with me, and that kind of thing. It's just the beginning, but it's like the foundation, you know, for like a personal content empire. You know, it's like,
that's where the future is, man. I truly believe that's where the future of independent film is going. It's not this one movie that's going to get me to where I want to go. It's like, it's going to be the grind. It's the film after film, building a portfolio, not selling out to distributors or creating some hybrid distribution deal where you maintain some sort of control over your film, not for 15 years, but for 5 or 3. Right. Things like, you know, there's so many different ways of going about it. And this is the future. I think that what you're doing is fantastic.
I think that one of the tricks, though, is to keep it coherent in its own universe. Mm-hmm. Because people want, you know, we see this with binging on Netflix and that kind of thing. I find that audiences, if they're going to invest in your thing, your story, they want to be like rewarded for that investment. And you got to do that by giving them another story just like the other one. I'm not saying the same plot or anything. I'm saying like the same world. Allow them to dive into something that you keep building out for them, that keeps them in and interested in that world. I think as filmmakers, we want to always do something new and novel and all that. But if you can commit to a story world with characters within it that you can explore, I think that's better. I think it's better to corral everything under some kind of unifying concept. Like, you know, I'll use the obvious example of Star Wars. Star Wars is like a world and all this – or universe, frankly, and all this stuff is in it, right? And there's no dearth of story material. There's always this new spur, some place to go. I think if I can encourage anyone, if you want to build a foundation that blossoms into a business, keep it consistent unto itself. And I know that can feel like you're locking yourself into something. But if at all possible, because synergies develop, right? And I'm not like selling like, you know, millions of copies of Quantum Deadline, but I've sold more this year with this movie because of the relationship between those two projects than I have prior to the, you know, and I'm hopefully one feeds the other, that kind of thing. And as I roll out new material that speaks, that plays in the same playground, it'll keep growing exponentially.
And it's similar to what I've done with my films with like This Is Meg and, you know, which This Is Meg is not specifically a filmmaker movie, but it's a movie about the industry.
It's about an actress. Yeah.
It's about the industry, but it's also, you know, really, it's part of my ecosystem of indie film hustle. So yeah. I created multiple revenue streams off of it in addition to just the actual sales of it and licensing it and things like that. But now with Ego and Desire, which is coming out as of this recording, it's coming out in less than a month, hopefully. That is going to be real product placement and real interesting because that is a product that is designed for the tribe. Like it right. is designed for a filmmaker, an independent filmmaker. Like if I would see this commercial or I see this trailer, I'd be like, I've got to see that.
Right, right. No, that's totally. That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's your niche is kind of turning the camera back on the camera, you know, and exploring the nature of independent film. That's a perfect sweet spot for you. It's great. And everything dovetails perfectly. Right, it's a coherent brand proposition. I think you're onto something,
and that's what I've been trying to do. And I'm Shooting for the Mob, which is a book about my filmmaking, and then I've got the new book Rise of the Film. Like, if there's you could see the filmtrepreneur aspects of my business. I you have to an extent you've created multiple revenue streams coming in, and you're not retiring off of them. I'm not retiring off of anything. You know, it's work, it's a hustle, but it's It keeps the roof off over my head. Lights are on. Family is fed. We go on a vacation here or there. Life is good, you know? And I live in Los Angeles, for God's sakes.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, it's like I wish I lived somewhere else that, you know, my house didn't cost as much, you know? But I'm here. And in this kind of world that I'm building out as a film entrepreneur is something that's able to sustain me and my family. And you're doing something similar. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have on the show, man. It's really great stuff, man.
Oh, cool. Yeah, there's that threshold. I think for me, it's about 18, maybe 2 years out, where I hope that the revenue from all these endeavors begins to catch up and eclipse, you know, the other work I have to do. I'm a writer, so I write regardless. So, you know, I write for clients or I write for magazines and newspapers, that kind of thing. But I feel a tipping point's coming, and eventually it's going to, you know, and that's if you can make it like that, that's the best way to make it, man, where you made it yourself. And we all have help along the way and all that.
Yeah.
And we help others along the way, I hope. But ultimately, you built your own kingdom. You built your own empire, Alex. And I think that everyone should endeavor to do that, because I think we're going to be a bunch of micro studios in 5-10 years.
I agree with you 100%. We have to be our own businesses. We have to be our own corporations. We have to be our own studios. And I got to that tipping point probably around two and a half years in, is I got to that tipping point where I just said to my wife, I'm like, I don't think I need to do post anymore. If a directing gig comes along, I like it, I'll take it.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't have to do it anymore. And that is the most wonderful feeling for someone who's been hustling for 20 odd years in this business to just wake up every morning and go do what I love to do. It's the dream. It really is the dream. I'm so blessed and humbled by it. And that's what you're doing on your end with your films, man. So yeah, congrats, man. Seriously.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. I have to say though, the way you do things, I really appreciate the openness and the way that you share how you accomplish these things. That's something I'm trying to engineer, figure out a way to incorporate into what I'm doing. So because the give back factor is pretty huge. I mean, as we talked earlier, without listening to Indie Film Hustle and all that, and kind of keeping the spirit of film alive in my head, I don't think I would have gotten to this point. And I think that if there's a way that filmmakers can bake in some kind of way of acknowledging or helping kind of keep the community growing, all the better. I don't know what that is for me yet. Perhaps I'll figure it out. But
I don't know who said this, but if I forgot who the philosopher said this, but he says if you want to succeed, help someone else succeed.
Right.
And then
steal from them.
Steal from them. Then knock them over the head and take from them. No, but I've discovered by giving is the greatest strength I have, is because I am of service to my community. I give as much as I possibly can. Sometimes I even give too much. I give away 95% of my information for free. And I only charge for about 5% of what I do every day on a daily basis. You know, I could easily, there's some podcasts that I do, some interviews with some people that I'm like, I could charge $20 for this. This is amazing information. And I give it away for free, because I just found and I discovered that when you pay it forward, man, it comes back to you. And now it's addictive for me. Like, I can't not give. I cannot be of service. It's part of my DNA now. So wherever I meet someone or I try, you know, there's only one of me, so I can't do it as much as I would like. But as much as you can give, and as filmmakers, you have to find that thing inside of you that you want to be of service. And that be of service could be making a regional movie for your community of a film that's a need in that marketplace, and you're being of service to that community, giving them a light that they haven't seen before. It doesn't have to be grandiose. It could be something very small, but when you discover that being of service aspect, and you should incorporate that in any way, shape, or form you can through your work, it's so much better than the me vibe that I had back in the day when I was coming up, when my ego was out of control and all sorts of craziness that I've gone through in my career. That's why anytime I meet a filmmaker, which I'm sure you've met too, who are just so ridiculous. That's why I made Ego and Desire, because I just had to make fun. They're so ridiculous that I say, it's all good, man. There's nothing I need to say to you. The business will take care of you. Life will take care of you.
Yeah.
And you might have some success here or there, but I promise you the hammer's coming. It always comes. I don't care who you are. It always comes. So you will be humbled if it's not. Yes. It's not me to do it. I won't humble you. It's all, you do.
I think that there's a tick in filmmakers. I think filmmakers, especially in the indie realm, are intrinsically problem solvers, right? Yeah. Constantly figuring out how to do something or fix something or whatever, or patch a hole somewhere. And I think when you see problems in like the community, like in terms of like accomplishing something or making a film, that kind of thing, like there's an impulse to want to fix it or help somebody, like, dude, you're doing this wrong, man. This is how you do it. And I think maybe that's where it comes from at first, where you just like, oh, I got to help this guy. He's you know, he's going to waste everything here. And I don't know. It's a fascinating place to be. Maybe it's just, maybe I'm just getting older, you know, and
don't underestimate the power of age, brother. I'm telling you, man. I mean, when I was 20, I would slap myself. You know, it takes years of shrapnel. It takes that kind of that rhinoceros skin that you've got to develop because of all the just the bruising and the battles and the punches and the cuts and the scarring that you have to go through in this business. And I'm not being dramatic. It's the truth. Like, we all go through it. And as you get older, you just start figuring things out. And that's what I try to do with this podcast. I try to like give them a little bit of a shortcut. I still want them to go through their pain, but it's one thing to be sideswiped by an MMA fighter who's sitting next to you. And another thing is if someone says, dude, there's an MMA fighter right next to you and you will be punched any minute now. There's a huge difference between – you're going to get punched. But understanding and preparing for that punch is a whole other story.
Well put. Yeah, good. The MMA metaphor. I love it. Yeah,
yeah. It's I always call ego is the MMA fighter that sits on your shoulder. That's what ego is, because ego, he'll be quiet sometimes. You'd be like, quiet down. He's fine. But he's just waiting for that moment where there's an opening. And there's always that moment. And you're like, hey, maybe I am not that. Boom. And that's it. You're out. Like, hey, maybe I am really this good. Boom. There you go. You're out. And ego is always there waiting for you, and you've got to kind of flatten it, and it takes forever. So I use that analogy all the time, that MMA fighter is always on my shoulder.
I love it. No, it's good. It's good.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my filmtrepreneurs, sir.
Yeah.
What advice would you give a filmtrepreneur starting a project today?
Really focus on the writing. That's the one thing you can do for free yourself and get right with enough practice and dedication to it. Make sure that script is story worthy and shooting worthy first. Just you can't fix bad writing in post. You can edit around some stuff, but even in my own experience, there are scenes where I go, you know, if I just spent one more day on a draft, I could have cleared up a lot of problems for myself. Just make sure the thing's written first. Write it.
Fair enough. Now, what is the biggest lesson you learned from building your company, building what you're trying to do with your film company?
So, go in on getting professional advice for setting it up correctly. If you're going to do an LLC or a sole proprietorship, whatever you're going to do, just make sure you actually set it up as a business and do it legitimately. Sometimes if you're going to have if your business is going to have what they call a fictitious name, and by that it's like a DBA. Name that's not your own. Yeah, DBA. Right. Go through the hoops. Check all the boxes. It's worth it, and it sets you up for success. You don't want to have to like mess with your taxes. You don't want to have to mess with all the stuff that's just going to slow you down artistically. Do it right, and if you have to pay a little bit for it, do that.
And get an accountant.
And yeah, that's a great point. Accountants,
get an accountant. It's cheap.
Totally. A bookkeeper is way cheaper than you think, you know.
And it's a lot cheaper than you doing it yourself, man. I can tell you that much.
Especially when you mess it up. Yeah. Especially in production, having a bookkeeper – I didn't have one in Pillhead, and I really wish I did, because it would have been so much easier just to have it happening every week. Everyone gets paid versus, dude, can I get my check? It's midnight. I'm, you know, like, we're
hold
only
on. Let me get the book out.
Yeah. No. Just – pay the $200 or whatever. It's nothing. Yeah.
It's a good ROI and an ROT, return on time and return on investment.
Because
you know, a lot of us are, as filmmakers, especially us guys who are at the micro budget level, we always want to save a buck, but you've got to be smart on where you save it. Because if you save $5, but if you pay that $5 and that $5 will save you an hour or two in work or time, is your time worth more than $5?
Right.
Could you be doing something else that could generate more revenue or help the project farther along? That is such a huge, huge thing.
That's a great point. Let the pros do the pro stuff, you know? Yeah.
Fair enough. Now, what did you learn from your biggest business failure?
Well, that wasn't necessarily this project.
No, not in this business, in general.
There's a lot of people who are often not invested in your success.
Shocking.
And yes. And it's important to recognize that and get rid of them early. Not that anyone may be intentionally sabotaging you, but they may unconsciously have a grudge and you might be carrying them with you and you want to drop them as soon as you can. We see this in creative stuff sometimes, you know.
Just not all the time, just sometimes.
Just sometimes. Those guys suck. You know, there are energy vampires, you know, that they want to be close to you because you got the thing and they don't, and they're going to take it from you bit by bit, drop by drop.
And it's paper cuts, death by paper cuts.
Yeah. And they may not even know they're doing it. Get rid of them. Mm-hmm. It's okay to get rid of them. Yeah.
It took me a long time to figure that out. Now, in your opinion, what is the definition of a filmtrepreneur?
A filmtrepreneur is someone who endeavors to make filmmaking their life and livelihood. And by pragmatic and judicious execution of their talent in the cinematic space.
You're a wordsmith, sir, obviously.
I don't know. That sounds a little put on. let me try that again. I was reaching there. A filmtrepreneur is somebody who knows that to make films, they have to make films that sustain them ultimately. And so by being smart as well as pragmatic is the way to go.
Now, where can people find you, your movie, and what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm at dhowell, that's dhowell.com. And if you want to go directly to the business, it's culturedepartment.com. It's culturedept.com. I'm at Facebook at Daedalus, don't even bother. Can't even spell it. Never mind. But dhowell.com. There's links everywhere, I swear. And then Pillhead's on Amazon. Go to Amazon and watch Pillhead. You can see how I did it. Yeah.
Is it on Prime or is it on just rental? And
it's on Prime. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Fantastic. Are you finding that you're making good money on Prime as opposed to rental and purchase?
That's a great question. I'm finding it's not quite as juicy in terms of Prime, but Prime's kind of a long-term play for me because I'm trying to push it a lot, and it's easier to get people to watch it if they're not paying out of pocket.
You know,
it's a little frictionless, and so I'm kind of in a marketing push right now, and so I'm sending out links to bloggers and stuff like that. I want them to be able to click it, watch it, love it, talk about it. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. So yeah, there's a little bit of a decline, but you know, the great thing about Prime though, it's like it's opened up in the UK now, so the film's kind of getting a different audience, that kind of thing. Less friction, long-term play. I'm still on the fence about it a little bit, to be honest.
But you're huge in Turkey, so that's all really that matters.
Yes.
You can't walk the streets in Turkey, sir. So
I can't anyway, as it turns out. But yeah.
Brother, man, I appreciate you coming on and being so transparent and forthcoming with the tribe, man. So thank you so much for dropping those knowledge bombs, brother.
Oh, thanks for having me, man. This is a real privilege and pleasure. I really, truly appreciate it, man. Thank you.
I want to thank Daedalus so much for coming on and sharing his knowledge bombs with the tribe today. If you want to check out his movie or links to anything we talked about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/025. And for everyone who has signed up for Indie Film Hustle TV, I just wanted to give you an update. We have a bunch of new courses that I'm uploading. The Story Blueprint by Michael Haig and Chris Vogler, The Hero's Two Journeys, a detailed breakdown of the story structure of the Oscar-winning film Aaron Brockovich, and much, much more. And I am uploading exclusive filmtrepreneur interviews that have not been released on the podcast yet. You'll be able to listen and watch those full interviews first on IFH TV. So I'll be putting those up as well moving forward. And I will be creating specific filmtrepreneur training to enhance the book and to go deeper into what you learned in Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, and that will all be available on Indie Film Hustle TV. If you want to check it out, head over to ifhtv.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys. I hope that this episode was of value to you on your filmtrepreneurial journey. Thanks for listening. As always, the power is in your hands. Be a filmtrepreneur. And viva the revolution. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.